good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're listening to episode 535 of Unwelcome Guests. Peter Dale Scott on the American War Machine. I'm Robin Upton. This week's show, we've got nearly 2 hours of audio from the softly spoken and meticulously researched Canadian professor of English, Peter Dale Scott. Now, he's best known for his books, so I was delighted when I found online a 90-minute video interview from Maverick Media, which provides most of the audio for this show. That is on the contents of his new book, The American War Machine. But to begin with, we're going to hear half an hour on continuity of government planning. This is from the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz in June 2010.
So, let me begin my talk now. First, the title, Continuity of Government Planning, the process by which the U.S. Constitution has already been superseded. In July 1987, during the Iran-Contra hearings, grilling of Oliver North, the American public got a glimpse of a, quote, highly sensitive, close quote, secret that North had been involved in emergency plans to suspend the American Constitution in the event of a nuclear attack. And I'm going to quote from the hearings, and this was printed the next day in the New York Times, but as you listen to it, you may be interested that not one newspaper ever commented on the content of this interchange. Congressman Jack Brooks from Texas, thank God for Texas. Colonel North, in your work at the NSC, were you not assigned at one time to work on plans for the continuity of government in the event of a major disaster? And then North's lawyer jumped up, Mr. Chairman! And then the senator, Daniel Inouye, who was a Democrat, the chair of the committee, responded in a way that showed he knew exactly what Brooks was referring to. And this is what he said. I believe that that question touches upon a highly sensitive and classified area, so may I request that you not touch on that. Jack Brooks, I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read in Miami papers and several others that there had been a plan developed by that same agency, a contingency plan in the event of emergency, that would suspend the American Constitution. And I was deeply concerned about it and wondered if that was an area in which he had worked. I believe that it was, and I wanted to get his confirmation. Then Inouye again, may I most respectfully request that that matter not be touched upon at this stage. If we wish to get into this, I'm certain arrangements can be made for an executive session. End of quote. How many people never knew that happened in Iran-Contra? Well, it sort of freaked us at the time, and then it just disappeared from view. So let me go on. We have never heard if there ever was or was not an executive session, or if the rest of Congress was ever made aware of the matter. Reportedly, Congress as a whole was bypassed altogether. Two books say that Congress was completely left out of this planning, though key individuals may have known. I suspect Lee Hamilton, but I can't prove it. Jack Brooks was responding to a story by Alfonso Chardy in the Miami Herald. Chardy's story alleged that Oliver North was involved with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, in plans to take over federal, state, and local functions during a national emergency. This planning for continuity of government, COG, and that's what I'll say from now on, called for, quote, suspension of the Constitution, turning control of the government over to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, emergency appointment of military commanders to run state and local governments, and declaration of martial law. Close quote. To my knowledge, no one in the public, including myself, attached enough importance to the Chardy story. Chardy himself suggested that Reagan's Attorney General, William French Smith, had intervened to stop the COG plan from being presented to the president. 7 years later, in 1994, Tim Weiner reported in the New York Times that what he called the Doomsday Project, the search for, quote, ways to keep the government running after a sustained nuclear attack on Washington, close quote, was going to be closed down and had less than 6 months to live. Technically, Weiner's story may have been correct, but it was also very misleading. On the basis of that report, the first two books on COG planning, by James Bamford and by James Mann, books otherwise excellent and well-informed, reported that COG planning had been abandoned. They were wrong. What they and Weiner did not report was that under Reagan, the purpose of COG planning had been changed. COG plans now called for suspension of the Constitution, not just after a nuclear war, but for any national security emergency. This was defined in Executive Order 12656 of 1988 as, quote, any occurrence, including natural disaster, military attack, technological emergency, or other emergency that seriously degrades or seriously threatens the national security of the United States. That's the language of the order. In other words, extraordinary emergency measures originally designed for an America devastated in a nuclear attack were now to be applied to anything the White House considered an emergency. This expanded goal was envisaged as early as 1984, when, according to Boston Globe reporter Ross Geldspan, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North was working with officials of FEMA to draw up a secret contingency plan to surveil political dissenters and to arrange for the detention of hundreds of thousands of undocumented aliens in case of an unspecified national emergency. The plan, part of which was codenamed Rex 84, called for the suspension of the Constitution under a number of scenarios, including a U.S. invasion of Nicaragua. Clearly, 9/11 met this definition, any emergency, and we know for a certainty that COG planning was instituted on that day in 2001. What few have recognized is that it is still in effect. The Constitution has indeed been superseded. COG plans are still authorized by a proclamation of emergency that has been extended each year by presidential authority, most recently by President Obama in September 2009. On 9/11, before the last plane had crashed in Pennsylvania, the White House authorized the institution of COG plans. There is no doubt that it was introduced. The 9/11 report confirms it twice on pages 38 and 326. COG plans are also the probable source for the Patriot Act that appeared from nowhere, and also for the Department of Homeland Security's Project Endgame, a 10-year plan to expand detention camps at a cost of $400 million in fiscal year 2007 alone. Homeland Security once said that it was to handle all the illegal immigrants in this country. Well, there are about 12 million of them, so that is an ambitious plan. And, of course, what will work for immigrants will also work for those political agitators that were being talked about in the Rex 84 plan. The most repressive features of the Bush presidency were apparently all sketched out in COG planning: warrantless surveillance, warrantless detention, even suspension of our right of habeas corpus, first granted by Magna Carta in 1215, all planned long before Bush took office. Much is known about COG plans. Much more is not known. We don't know exactly what is in fact at all. We know that the ultra-secret planning began in the 80s under Reagan and North and continued under George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. Two of the key planners on the secret planning committee were Cheney and Rumsfeld, the two men who implemented it under 9/11, even though when Clinton was president, both men, both Republicans, were heads of major corporations and were not even in the government at all. So we should not be surprised that with implementation came the warrantless detentions that Oliver North had planned for two decades earlier, the warrantless eavesdropping that is their logical counterpart, and the militarization of the domestic United States under a new military command, NORTHCOM. Through NORTHCOM, the U.S. Army now is engaged with local law enforcement to control America in the same way that through CENTCOM it is engaged with local law enforcement to control Afghanistan and Iraq. We have now become a military district where the Army operates the suspension in effect of the Posse Comitatus Acts, which restricted it from doing this until the COG planning was implemented. We learned that COG planning was still active in 2007 when President Bush issued National Security Presidential Directive 51, NSPD 51. This, for the sixth time, extended for 1 year the emergency proclaimed on September 14, 2001, and empowered the president to personally ensure continuity of government in the event of any catastrophic emergency. Bush announced that NSPD 51 contains classified continuity annexes which shall, quote, be protected from unauthorized disclosure. Under pressure from his 9/11 truth constituents, Congressman Peter DeFazio of the Homeland Security Committee twice requested to see these annexes. The second time in a written letter signed by the chair of his committee, the Homeland Security Committee. His request was denied. They did not have the clearances to see the annexes. Now, the National Emergencies Act, one of the post-Watergate reforms that Vice President Cheney so hated, specifies that, this is in the U.S. statutes, not later than 6 months after a national emergency is declared, and not later than the end of each six-month period thereafter that such emergency continues, each House of Congress shall meet to consider a vote on a joint resolution to determine whether that emergency shall be terminated. It's not that they can do it, may do it. They are required by law to do it. Yet in 9 years, Congress has not once met to discuss the state of emergency declared by George W. Bush in response to 9/11, a state of emergency which remains in effect today. Appeals to the Congress to meet its responsibilities to review COG have fallen on deaf ears. Former Congressman Dan Hamburg and I appealed publicly last year, both to Obama to terminate the emergency and to Congress to hold the hearings required of them by statute. But Obama, without discussion, extended the 9/11 emergency again on September the 10th, 2009. There was actually a press conference and some other minor thing was discussed. This was not mentioned or discussed in the press conference. And Congress has continued to ignore its statutory obligations. One congressman explained to a constituent that the provisions of the National Emergencies Act have now been rendered inoperative. How? By COG. If true, this would seem to justify Chardy's description of COG as suspension of the Constitution. Are there other parts of the Constitution that have been suspended? We do not know, and Congress has been told it cannot find out. Now, I don't know if it's my background as a Canadian, Karen, that leads me so focused on this legal question of COG. Plans drafted by a secret committee, including corporation heads not in the government, have provided rules that override public law and the separation of powers that is at the heart of the Constitution. Congress is derelict in addressing this situation. Even Congressman Kucinich, the one congressman I have met, will not answer my communications on this subject. What offends me most is that America has become a country where a group of men, including some not even in the government, were able to plan successfully for the imposition of these secret rules. As I see it, the only authorization for the COG planning was a secret decision by President Reagan, NSD 55 of September 14, 1982, which happens to be the same day in which the emergency was proclaimed 19 years later, which in effect federalized the counterinsurgency planning called Cable Splicer, which Reagan had authorized in California when he was governor there. I submit that the planning by Cheney, Rumsfeld, and others in the last two decades was not confined to a response to an emergency. The 1,000-page Patriot Act, which was dropped on Congress as promptly as the Tonkin Gulf resolution had been back in 64, is still with us from day to day. Congress has never seriously challenged it, and Obama quietly signed a one-year extension of three controversial sections of it on February 27th of this year. Now, we should not forget that the Patriot Act was only passed after lethal anthrax letters were mailed to two crucial Democratic senators, Senators Daschle and Leahy, who had been questioning it and who subsequently reversed their initial opposition to the bill after receiving the anthrax letters. Someone, we still do not know who, must have planned those anthrax letters well in advance. This is a fact most Americans do not want to think about. Someone also must have planned the new instructions on June 1, 2001, determining that military interceptions of hijacked aircraft had to be approved at the, quote, highest levels of government. This meant in practice, in fact, on that day, Cheney and Rumsfeld, because Bush was in a plane circling over the southern United States that had lost its communications system with the rest of the government. The report attributes this order to a JCS memo of June 1, 2001, entitled Aircraft Piracy and Destruction of Derelict Airborne Objects. But there was no such written requirement before June 1, 2001, and I am informed that it was quietly revoked in December 2001. They went back to the old system where, if a plane went off course, it was just a matter of routine for jets to take up. Intercept doesn't mean shoot it down. It means just gets on the wings. That now had to be approved by Cheney and Rumsfeld. And, well, you know, most of you know what a mess all of that was on 9/11. In the road to 9/11, I suggest that the change in the JCS memo came from the National Preparedness Review, in which President Bush, in May of 2001, authorized Vice President Cheney, together with, guess who, FEMA, to tackle the task of dealing with terrorist attacks, close quote. Not noticed by the press was the fact that Cheney and FEMA had already been working on COG planning as a team throughout the 1980s and 1990s. Not just the mainstream press, but even excellent authors like James Bamford and James Mann have underestimated the enormity of what happened. Let me quote again from my book, The Road to 9/11. In April 1994, Tim Weiner announced in the New York Times that in the post-Soviet Clinton era, the Doomsday Project, as it was known, was to be closed. Weiner added that while some continuity of programs continue under the aegis of Pentagon planners, they are pale versions of the vision laid out by Reagan in 83. They are realizing these requirements are throwbacks to the Cold War, nuclear analyst Bruce Blair said. They are not relevant to today's world. This article persuaded authors James Mann and James Bamford that Reagan's COG plans had now been abandoned because, quote, there was, it seemed, no longer any enemy in the world capable of decapitating America's leadership, close quote. In fact, however, only one phase of COG planning had been terminated, a Pentagon program for response to a nuclear attack. Instead, according to author Andrew Coburn in his biography of Rumsfeld, a new target was found. And now a long quote from Coburn. Although the exercises continued, still budgeted at over $200 million a year in the Clinton era, the vanished Soviets were now replaced by terrorists. Exactly. There were other changes, too. In the earlier times, the specialists selected to run the shadow government had been drawn from across the political spectrum, Democrats and Republicans alike. But now, down in the bunkers, Rumsfeld found himself in politically congenial company, the players' roster being filled almost exclusively with Republican hawks. Quote, it was one way for these people to stay in touch. They'd meet, do the exercise, but also sit around and castigate the Clinton administration in the most extreme way, close quote, a former Pentagon official with direct knowledge of the phenomenon told me, that is to say Coburn. Quote, again, the official, you could say this was a secret government in waiting. The Clinton administration was extraordinarily inattentive. The Clinton government had no idea what was going on, close quote. Now, Coburn's account requires some qualification. Richard Clark, a Clinton Democrat, makes it clear that he participated in the COG games in the 1990s, and indeed he himself drafted Clinton's Presidential Decision Directive 67 on enduring constitutional government and continuity of government. But COG planning involved different teams for different purposes. I suspect that the Pentagon official was describing the Department of Defense team dealing with retaliation to a terrorist attack. The Pentagon official's description of a, quote, secret government in waiting, close quote, which included both Cheney and Rumsfeld, who were indeed waiting, is very close to the standard definition of a cabal, as a group of persons secretly united to bring about a change of government. In the same era, Cheney and Rumsfeld projected change also by their public lobbying through the project for the new American century, for a more militant Middle East policy. In light of how COG was actually implemented in 2001, one can legitimately suspect that however interested this group had been in continuity of government under Reagan, under Clinton, the focus of Cheney's and Rumsfeld's COG planning, the focus was now a change of government. Understandably, there is great psychological resistance to the extraordinary claim that Cheney and Rumsfeld, even when not in government, were able to help plan successfully for constitutional modifications which they themselves then implemented when back in power. Most people cannot bring themselves even to believe the second known half of this claim, that on September the 11th, 2001, two COG plans overriding the Constitution were indeed implemented. That is why the first two print reviews of my book, The Road to 9/11, were both favorable, both intelligently written, both reported that I had speculated that COG had been imposed on 9/11. No, It was not a speculation. The 9/11 Commission report twice confirms that COG was instituted on the basis of a phone call between Bush and Cheney, of which the Commission could find no record. No record, I did speculate in my book, because it took place on a secure COG telephone outside the presidential bunker with such a high classification that the 9/11 Commission was never supplied the phone records. A footnote in the 9/11 report says, the 9/11 crisis tested the government's plans and capabilities to ensure the continuity of constitutional government and the continuity of government operations. We did not investigate this topic, except as needed to understand the activities and communications of key officials on 9/11, which in this respect they did not understand and admitted they did not. The chair, vice chair, and senior staff, that's Lee Hamilton again, were briefed on the general nature and implementation of these continuity plans. The other footnotes confirm that no information from COG files was used to document the 9/11 report. At a minimum, these files might resolve the mystery of the missing phone call which authorized COG. I suspect that they might tell us a great deal more, such as the exercises that took place on that day. What is the first step out of this current state of affairs in which the Constitution has in effect been superseded by a higher, if less legitimate, authority? I submit that it is to get Congress to do what the law requires and determine whether our present proclamation of emergency shall be terminated as required under 50 U.S.C. 1622, paragraph 2002. That's the part of the U.S. Code which requires this. An earlier, polite, judiciously worded appeal to this effect failed. It may be necessary to raise the issue in a larger, albeit more controversial context, the scandal that a small cabal was able to supersede the Constitution and Congress has failed despite repeated requests to do anything about it. And that's what I hope left and right in this room can agree on, that something should be done to restore our Constitution to the effect that it was in before 2001. I don't know what the situation is. I know that a congressman tried to find out what the situation is and was told that he didn't have the authority to do so, even though he and the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee were requesting this in writing. They don't know, I don't know, but we know there are COG annexes being added to. The latest we know of were added in 2007. Yes, they are still in force. I was very interested in Ellen Brown's talk this morning because I feel that she was absolutely right to draw an analogy between the unknown forces which engineered the fall of Lehman Brothers and the unknown forces which engineered 9/11. And I wanted to ask her, because at one point she said that all these bankers were doing what seemed best to them, but at another point she really seemed to be implying that the system had been gamed by some sinister force in order to bring about a profound economic change. And that is what I see myself, though I can't prove it, as there was a similar political gaming on the 9/11 2001 side to bring around this change in COG. The most important part, which I haven't developed in this talk, but I write about it in The Road to 9/11, was this project endgame of the Department of Homeland Security to provide a whole new system of detention camps. And the justification for it is almost exactly the justification for the camps that North was working on back in the 1980s, in other words, to deal with the problem of illegal immigrants. But, of course, the detention camps are fungible. They can be used for us as well as for illegal immigrants. And the other thing is NORTHCOM. That was done with almost no debate at all. And by the way, it was also done in my country, Canada. Britain went through a very similar convulsion almost immediately after 9/11. And then Canada has militarized itself. An American army can now march into Canada, or more likely fly into Canada, without any authorization from the civilian government of Canada because of this NORTHCOM, NORAD planning, which is escaping from civilian review. So all of this concerns me very much, but I can't answer your question. We just know there's something out there, it's big, and nobody's talking about it. And the great disappointment was when we got a Democratic president. He's not committed to the Bush agenda. He did not vote for going into Iraq. But he's extending the cloak of secrecy about this. That's very disturbing, I think.
A very underreported topic, I think, not only, of course, in corporate-owned media, but even in independent media, people putting things up on the internet and so on. There is very little on continuity of government that I've come across, so I would encourage you to spread this further. If the American law mandates that this is reviewed every 6 months, and it's never been reviewed in 9 years, does anybody care? Well, yes, of course, Peter Dale Scott cares, and some of us care, but I think the calculations of a rather ruthless elite go. If those laws are inconvenient for them, it's a simple matter to prevent their discussion from being carried out on commercial media, and they can then safely be ignored. If that is the calculation, then programs such as this one, radio stations that carry it, and means of communication such as the internet, represent a challenge to that idea, which may explain legislation being drafted on restriction of access to the internet, especially restriction of publishing ability on the internet. Now let's turn to the soundtrack of another video. This is a talking head that I found on Vimeo.com and posted in December. A couple of parts of this had listenership which was measured in dozens rather than hundreds, thousands or millions. What a different country America is likely to become when a large majority of American people understand messages similar to that of Peter Dale Scott.
Thank you for joining Pulse TV. I'm your host, Cindy Peister, and today we're visiting with Professor Peter Dale Scott. Professor Scott was a Canadian diplomat. He worked. He taught 30 years with UC Berkeley teaching English. He's a poet. His poem, Road to Jakarta, one of the most important poems in decades, a political poem. He's the foremost voice for peace, an author of numerous books independently and also co-authoring with other authors. He has a new book out, American War Machine, Deep Politics, the CIA Global Drug Connection, and the Road to Afghanistan. Professor Scott, thank you so much.
Well, I'm glad to be with you.
When you decided to write this book, what made you decide to write it? What is the premise of the book?
I've been writing now since the Vietnam War, and every new book that I've written, there are about six or seven, grow out of my original frustration at seeing America go into Vietnam. And I had been a Canadian diplomat for 4 years, had a tiny bit of exposure to the Indochina question and the agonies of the French at that time. And so I began by simply wanting to keep America out of Vietnam. But the more I researched this, I became interested in the forces that drew us into Vietnam, and particularly what distinguished my Vietnam research, that I became quite obsessed with the fact that the essential commitment to escalate the war into an American war was made the weekend of November 22nd, 1963, within 48 hours of the assassination of President Kennedy. So those two subjects, assassination and war, have been linked in my mind. And of course, I've gone hot and cold on this and was relatively inactive in the 80s and 90s. Well, the 90s, I did a book about the Kennedy assassination. But when we had 9/11, and then that was immediately followed by a new war, first in Afghanistan and also, as clearly was going to happen, in Iraq. That, I guess, is the immediate cause why I wrote really two books, The Road to 9/11, which came out in 2007. And then I had some chapters left over that didn't fit into The Road to 9/11. I thought they were the best chapters, so, which is about the rise of the drug trade in Southeast Asia and the role of the CIA. So I essentially wrote the book to create a home for those chapters. And then while I was writing it, the war in Afghanistan escalated. So my book, this latest book, American War Machine, spans the period from the early 50s and the growth of the drug trade in Southeast Asia up to Afghanistan and the growth of the drug trade there.
An incredible book, years of research in that. So much of our own American history as it unfolds is being hidden from us. For example, we didn't know that the weapons of mass destruction were not true at the time, and we went to war on that basis. So the term the Matrix, American Empire, of what's going on in the United States today, where Americans are blind to our own political involvement domestically and internationally, how would you term that?
I'm very aware, and have been for really since the 60s, that there's, in addition to the America that we read about in the newspapers, and there's also a deeper dimension to what's going on, which is why I've coined the phrase deep politics, and that beneath the surface there are events that happen. I also now am talking, since 9/11, I've come to talk also about deep events, events which are treated as totally external, like the killing of the president, supposed to have been done by a lone nut, and therefore not very interesting historically, or 9/11, it's 19 people coming from Asia. I call these deep events because we've had a number of them now, Watergate, Iran-Contra. And over and over, we develop more and more the sense that these are events we're not going to get the truth on. We're not going to go to the bottom of. And in the case of 9/11, it took 3 years before the president even agreed to, or sorry, 2 years, to have a commission. And the commission, more and more, even the chairman of it has said they didn't get to the bottom of things. They've said that people lied to them at the commission. Those of us who are aware of deep politics, that's what we now expect in a deep event, that there will be cover-up, that the American people will not be allowed to get to the truth of things. There are such elemental facts that are mysterious about 9/11 that weren't even looked at by the commission. There's not a word about them in the 9/11 report. For example, who were the hijackers? Now, we were given a list of names within an hour before the last plane went down. The FBI was sharing who the hijackers were. But within 6 days, there were about three or four people who came forward in other parts of the world and said, that's me, that's my photograph. But obviously, I wasn't on one of those planes. And the FBI, back in September 2001, said, we will have to investigate this. Not a word about this in the 9/11 Commission report. It simply assumes that the names we have are the right names. And there's the question of how World Trade Center Building 7 went down. It wasn't hit by a plane. There was another building between it and the towers that didn't go down. And yet this building suddenly, about 5 o'clock that afternoon, collapse in about 7 seconds. And that question had been given to the commission to look at, and there's not a word about it. So we're barely at square one with the 9/11 commission report. And I have to say, We still, after almost 50 years, don't know the truth of what happened in Dallas, Texas in 1963. Those are deep events, and they affect our history. It's not inconsequential that after Kennedy was killed, his plans to take troops out of Vietnam were annulled, and we were involved in a hot war in Vietnam. The excuse was the Tonkin Gulf incident of 64, but it's now absolutely clear, A, that the second incident, which is why American planes went and bombed North Vietnam and started the hot war with North Vietnam, it's now clear that incident didn't happen. And what's even more alarming, it's now clear that people in Washington knew that it hadn't happened before the authorization was given to go ahead and send planes to attack North Vietnam. So that's why we talk about deep politics and deep history and deep events and deep forces that are making this happen that we don't fully understand. And I've devoted my life to this, really, but I don't claim to really understand these things. I just claim to be aware of these problems that need to be resolved.
So you've described deep events, but how would you define the term? How would you define deep?
When something happens and it very quickly becomes clear that we're not going to get to the bottom of the deep event. And I don't know if many people had that reaction. I didn't pay so much attention to the Kennedy assassination, but I must say, the moment that Lee Harvey Oswald, the supposed assassin, was killed on television by somebody who was quite strong links to the Dallas Underground, and that was covered up, it was clear to me back then in the mid-60s that this was I didn't call it that then, but this was an event where the truth was being concealed. And so I watched Watergate quite closely because I had the same feeling. And I watched Iran-Contra. I actually went to Washington. It was a background consultant to Senator Kerry when he was looking into the drug aspects of the Contra activities. And the strong sense, another thing in all these things, it turns out there's some kind of CIA or intelligence involvement in all of them, and that is the point of sensitivity, that these things aren't being, some of the things are not being exposed because the CIA doesn't want them exposed. That's very clear in the Kennedy assassination, and I would say increasingly clear now in those other events that I've mentioned as well.
In 1971, you had a personal experience that seems to have impact in your ongoing work now. Would you like to describe to us what happened and its relevance to your current work?
You're talking about an event with which I open this new book, American War Machine. And ironically, I now think it was quite a significant event. Well, I'll tell it first, and then you'll see why I think it's important. I had already published an article about narcotics and the war in Vietnam and the involvement of the CIA in helping to back the troops in Burma that were growing the poppy, which was creating a huge source of income for capitalists in Southeast Asia. And a friend of mine, Alfred McCoy, was working on a similar book. His book came out, both our books came out the next year. Al McCoy was on his way, by the way, his book, The Politics of Heroin, is the Bible now in this area. That was a mainstream book, bestseller, and it's still in print after 30 years. On his way to Southeast Asia, he stopped here in Berkeley with me. I told him that I had been at a kind of unofficial war tribunal with a veteran of special forces who said he had seen heroin or opium being loaded onto CIA planes of Air America. We phoned to him in Palo Alto and said, would he do an interview? And he said, yes, he'd be happy to. So the next morning, Al and I drove in his car down to Palo Alto, and we reached this address. We walked up some steps and rang the doorbell, and the man came out with his fingers to his lips like this, indicating he didn't want us to talk. And okay, and then he motions us back down the stairs to his MG, which is parked in the street. And the MG has a steel door with a hole about this big in it, a huge hole. And he said, now he's talking down on the sidewalk, and he says, look at that hole. And he said, look at the floor of my MG. It's wooden. It's not even scorched, he said. That was an implosive device. It had to come from my old unit. So I can't talk to you. Well, what this meant was that somebody was listening to the phone call made from my house, and we had, I think by definition, this was a tiny act of terrorism, a relatively harmless one. All that got hurt was a car, but it was intended to terrorize him into not speaking, which is what he did. You know, I haven't had many things like this happen in my life. You'd think that I would remember it. I didn't. I forgot it. This is the point of the story, that it was so outside the scope of life as I normally live it in America, that my brain, instead of processing it, just suppressed it. And I wrote a long poem, as you mentioned, Coming to Jakarta, which was recovering all these repressed memories. And one of the last ones I recovered, and it took about 2 years, was this event with the MG and the story about drugs that never got told to us. Well, I saw Al McCoy at a conference about 2 or 3 months later and asked him if he remembered. And as I expected, he didn't remember it either. And at first, I said, okay, Al, you know, we went to interview that guy. What happened? And he said, well, I guess we didn't interview him. I said, yes, why didn't we interview him? And slowly, but it took time, we recovered the memory in his brain too. And to this day, his memory of it is not exactly mine. But the latest edition of his book, The Politics of Heroin, as I say, this mainstream book, in the preface, he quotes about 8 stanzas of my poem. That's his way of describing what happened that morning in Palo Alto. So you could say, in a way, this was a deep event, but a very small one, but not with the political consequences of things like Watergate and 9/11. But there is, again, I ask people watching this show, how do you explain what happened here? And I'm still at a loss of words. I say, because it had to do with drugs, I blame it on what I call the global drug connection. But do I mean forces inside the government from law enforcement did it? Or was it people in the drug trade? Or was it, I believe that there's a gray area in between where that distinction is not as clear as we would like it to be. I remember, to give another example, one of the first big anti-war marches in Berkeley back in 65, we wanted to go to the Oakland Army terminal where they were loading supplies for Vietnam. We knew we would never get there, but we were able to march through Berkeley. But when we got to the Oakland border, the Oakland police were there, and so were the Hell's Angels. Well, the Hell's Angels were a motorcycle gang, and everybody knew, although I don't know that I could prove it from books or anything, that they were heavily involved in dope distribution in the city of Oakland. And there, they were right next to the Oakland police, helping to block us from going in. One of the Hell's Angels actually rushed forward and broke the leg of a Berkeley policeman. But as far as I know, he was not arrested, because the Hell's Angels were a kind of unofficial law enforcement for the Oakland police, even though they were on the wrong side of the law. And there was a great deal of that back in the 60s. And I must say, in that respect, this is a perhaps a better country now than it was then. Another episode I mentioned in the book was Lowell Bergman, who is now famous on Frontline, and there was even a movie about him. He produces shows for PBS. In those days, he was at a small alternative anti-war newspaper in San Diego, and luckily he wasn't there that night that some people came by and threw a firebomb into the newspaper's office. It could have killed somebody. And it turned out that this was done with the unofficial tolerance and protection of the San Diego police. That was, the police were using these kind of irregular forces, and that's the kind of thing that my study of deep politics has focused on, the involvement of the underworld in quite important activities. For years, I've said, and I think the world has come around to agree with me, that Ruby, who's presented in the, Jack Ruby, I'm sorry, for younger people, the man who killed Lee Harvey Oswald on television on November 25th, 1963. The Warren Report said he was a loner, and it said that they actually, the FBI went to the Chicago underworld, to the top people in the underworld, and said, was he part of the mob? And Tony Accardo, who was the head of the Chicago underworld, said, no, he's not mob connected. And the Warren Report used that as proof that he wasn't mob connected. Well, he was mob connected, and one of my first books spent a lot of time proving that. And I must say that I now, I think, is accepted. The House Committee on Assassinations produced a 1,000-page report appendix which was Ruby's mob connections, but when I went through it, I realized that it too had been cherry-picked so that the crucial mob connections were left out of the 1,000 pages. This is more and more examples of how what reaches the public eye with respect to these deep events is heavily processed and the most relevant parts are suppressed. So I say, in addition to archival history, and I really fault the universities here, that they continue to talk as if Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone killer. And we have one kind of history that comes out of history departments, and then we have another kind of history, deep history, which you can now, thank goodness, read on the internet and hear about in programs like yours. But we have, if we want to live in a civilized, up-to-date, modern society, we pride ourselves in being an open society, and America deserves to pride itself on that. In many ways, it is a remarkable job of different national, ethnic groups and so on living together in a relatively open society. But there is this dark area of deep politics and unexplained deep forces. And I doubt that in my lifetime I will ever know the facts about how the door of that MG was blown open by an incendiary device. I just don't expect it to know that.
For our viewers, Professor Scott has written 4 different books related to the Kennedy assassinations.
The big one is Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. Before that, there was a sort of monograph called Crime and Cover-Up. And recently, there's a reissue of a book I did in 1972 called The War Conspiracy. But in the back of it, I have quite extended comparisons of 2 deep events that look totally dissimilar. The Kennedy assassination on 11/22/63, and then the events of 9/11/2001, but there are actually some rather disturbing similarities, and I'll just give 2. One is that the culprits were identified almost immediately with information was sent out that conformed to what was said. I'll take the Oswald example. They, within 15 minutes, they were looking for someone The height and the weight are exactly what was in Oswald's FBI file. It unfortunately wasn't Oswald's actual weight. He was, when they weighed his body 2 days later, wasn't 165 pounds, it was 141, which is quite significantly different. And yet, they used that to look for Oswald. And similarly, they had all these names of the hijackers within an hour, but it's now quite clear that whatever the facts about the hijackers, those were stolen identities, even to the photographs of, but one of the people who was living said, yes, I lost my passport some years ago. And there was this freak thing that, you know, they found two passports. One, they found a passport near the towers with the name of one of the hijackers. They found another passport in Pennsylvania near the thing. Nothing is said about this in the 9/11 Commission report because it looks like planted evidence, and that's another similarity. There was planted evidence to lead, a paper trail leading to the culprits in both cases. So anyway, in this book, I go into 15 analogies, and I worked at this for some time, and it was getting close to the end before I realized that one of the biggest analogies of all is that both events were followed by America going into a crazy war that it should not have gone into. First in Vietnam, more and more people now would say that was a tragic error, but it was also an obvious error. And then the same with Afghanistan, above all, Iraq. Iraq was totally insane. And how do we have in one of the most advanced countries in the world, the most highly educated, et cetera, et cetera. What has happened to our politics that it has at its center, this is the title, American War Machine. There's an aspect, we have a public constitution that's excellent. We have all kinds of processes for elections and so on, which on paper at least are very good. But at the center, particularly since World War II, we have developed a more and more highly concentrated secret apparatus that gets us involved in wars. And if we don't do something about it, it's going to get us involved in more wars. Because even if we get out of Afghanistan, as long as we have this war on terror, there's always going to be some terror. Terror isn't even an enemy, it's a technique. And if we were to be lucky enough to see, as President Obama wants, to see us start withdrawing from Afghanistan in 2011, and if that ends in peace, I make a certain prediction that drug production will go way down in Afghanistan, just as in the 1970s it went way down in Indochina, but then concurrently started to go way up in Afghanistan. So I foresee that if we get peace in Afghanistan and orderly control of the regions where the drugs are grown, drug production will go down in Afghanistan and will go up somewhere else, maybe Yemen, maybe Somalia, and if we don't do something about Washington, we will have new wars in Somalia. I've just started reading Bob Woodward's book, Obama's Wars, and he confirms what I already had read, that by the time Obama became president, the CIA was fighting the war on terror in 60 countries. This is a bigger world war than World War I and World War II when it comes to geography. Those wars weren't fought in 60 countries. And my understanding is that in the 2 years that Obama has been president, that it has expanded to still more countries, and Congress isn't doing anything about it.